Hey, welcome back. Ayahuasca could do something amazing to your brain, a new study shows, and science is finally catching up with the potential powers of this psychedelic drink. In a new study, researchers found the traditional psychoactive drug ayahuasca stimulates the growth of brain cells in the hippocampi of research mice. The hippocampus is responsible for many memory functions, and the mice dosed with ayahuasca also performed better in a battery of memory tests. You can read more about this fascinating story in the In the News section up at coasttocoastam.com. Back to more of my conversation with Tony Heller from Real Science, climatescience.com when Coast to Coast AM continues. Tony, do we even have a handle on whether CO2 drives temperature or whether an increase in temperature drives increased CO2 in the atmosphere? Do we know how it works?
Well, that's a very good question, Richard. Traditionally, if we look back in ice core records, going back, we have very good ice core records from Antarctica going back more than 600,000 years. And if you look in there, you can see there's a very clear relationship that temperature changes then drive the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. When during ice ages, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere decreases, and during warm periods, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increases. And the chemistry behind this is pretty basic, and it's one of the first things which geologists learn in school is cold seawater can hold more carbon dioxide in it than warm seawater can. And everyone who's ever opened up a warm beer understands this principle. If you open up a warm beer, the carbon dioxide comes fizzing out all over the place. And that's because the solubility of carbon dioxide in warm water is lower than it is in cold water. So when the oceans warm up, it outgasses carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And when the oceans cool down, the oceans absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. That's pretty much the way things have gone on for the past, 600,000 years, and actually much longer than that. But recently, so the theory is that now, we're burning all these fossil fuels, which are believed, a lot of them, like coal, are believed to be plant matter from plants which grew millions or hundreds of millions of years ago. They grew, then the plants fell into form peat beds in the ground, and then later that got buried and turned into coal. And then we burn it now, so we're releasing carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere, which has been trapped in these fossil plants for millions of years. So the idea is that now the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been increasing over the past century as a result of that. And so then the theory goes on that because we have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, this causes the temperature of the atmosphere to rise. So that's the basic theory behind the global warming idea. So it's actually the whole relationship is pretty complicated. But one thing that's very interesting is this year, we've had these lockdowns. Climate alarmists have been wanting for decades to shut down the airline industry. They claim that airplanes are huge causes of global warming and that people driving cars are. So this year, we've had, the airline industry has been decimated. People have been locked up in their homes all around the world. And so the theory is that the amount of carbon emissions, carbon dioxide emissions from our industrial civilization have been greatly reduced as a result of all these lockdowns. But if you look at the actual amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, they keep very accurate monitoring at Mauna Loa Mountain in Hawaii. If you look at they track it every single week. And if you look at it, you can see that there's been no slowdown in the rate of increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere this year. In fact, it might even have accelerated. So if it is human activity that's been driving up the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we should have seen a reduction in the rate of increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide this year, and it hasn't occurred. So this raises a lot of questions as to what's really going on here.
I interviewed Patrick Moore a number of years ago, the co-founder of Greenpeace, who left that organization, and now, like you, he's debunking a lot of the climate science out there, and he said that we're actually on a carbon dioxide starvation diet, that the optimal concentration. So, for example, someone who has a greenhouse, they're growing tomatoes, they will pipe in or pump in about 1,200 parts per million of CO2. That's the optimal level for plant growth. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, that's I think pretty much every commercial greenhouse operator in the world does this. Carbon dioxide has a couple of benefits for plants. The whole process of plant growth, photosynthesis involves sunlight, chlorophyll in the leaves, carbon dioxide, and water. Plants can't grow without those things. So carbon dioxide is the basis of life on Earth. And if you want your plants to grow faster, you give them more carbon dioxide, which has two benefits. One is the plant can absorb carbon more quickly and grow more quickly. But the other advantage is that it actually reduces the amount of water which the plant needs to survive. And when there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, plants are more drought resistant. So there's two huge benefits. And NASA has shown this very clearly. They've shown that over the past 50 years, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has made Earth greener. And they've measured this from satellites. So having more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is a benefit to plants. And if you look at crop yields have skyrocketed around the world over the past 50 years. And starvation has, the amount of hungry people in the world has dropped off tremendously. When I was a kid, half of India and China were starving to death. Now starvation is way down. And part of it is because we're able to grow more plants because there's more carbon, the plants grow more quickly because there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. If you go back, if you look back in Earth's history over the last 600 million years, which is what geologists do, we know that during times when there was a lot more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, Earth life thrived on Earth. The greatest expansion of life on Earth occurred 540 million years ago during the Cambrian era, and that's when corals evolved and shellfish evolved. And this was the peak level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It was 15 to 20 times higher than it is now. So when I hear climate alarmists making claims like, this extinction rebellion and how carbon dioxide is making the oceans more acidic and destroying corals, it's complete nonsense because we have hundreds of millions of years of Earth history with carbon dioxide levels much higher than they are now, and corals did great. And shellfish did great during that time. It's all just based on superstition and junk science, these sort of claims.
But what concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere would be optimal for humans? I would presume that 1,200 would not necessarily be healthy for humans. It may be great for plants.
Well, submarine, if you're on a crowded train and the carbon CO2 levels go up, you get up to like 4,000 or 5,000 parts per million. If you're sitting in a car with several other people with the windows rolled up, similarly, the carbon dioxide levels get up 3,000, 4,000, or 5,000 parts per million. So we regularly endure this. And in fact, the amount, your lungs have huge amounts of carbon dioxide in them. What your lungs do is they absorb oxygen. Then your blood burns, the carbon, the sugars in your bloodstream, and when you exhale carbon dioxide. And when you exhale, you're actually exhaling 40,000 parts per million of carbon dioxide, which is 100 times higher than the amount of CO2, the ambient CO2 in the atmosphere. So when you hear people making claims like increased carbon dioxide levels causes asthma, it's absurd because Obama made that claim that his daughter her asthma was due to carbon dioxide. It's just absurd because everybody's lungs has at least, yes, 40,000 parts per million for at least half the time in it. You know, I think a much better explanation for his daughter's asthma was probably the fact that he was smoking around her.
All right. What about sea levels? We often hear it claimed that sea levels are rising and that coastal cities will have to be evacuated. What's the actual data say?
Well, so if you go back 20,000 years ago, sea level was about 120 meters or 400 feet lower than it is now. We were in the middle of an ice age. You know, huge amounts of water was trapped as ice on land. You know, most of Canada was under miles of ice, as was much of the northeastern United States and Midwest. So sea levels were very low, and in fact, they were so low that people were able to walk across the Bering Strait from, you know, what's now Russia into Alaska. So sea levels were very low then, and about around 12,000 years ago, the ice started melting very quickly. So there was a huge rise in sea level from about 12,000 years ago until about 7,000 or 8,000 years ago due to glaciers melting. You know, at that time, Florida was about twice the size as it is now. But then the water rose, the glaciers melted, the water rose. And since then, over the last 7,000 years, you know, there's been a sort of a slower, steady rise in sea level. So we had 400 feet of sea level rise, which everyone agreed was natural. But somehow suddenly they're claiming now that the last few inches are man-made, which is absurd. And if you look at tide gauges, like there's with long-term records like the one, and there's a good one in Lower Manhattan, there's been no change in the rate of sea level rise there since Abraham Lincoln was president. And the 1990 IPCC report said there was no compelling evidence that sea level rise had accelerated during the 20th century. So the way that they came up with these statistics about increasing rates of sea level rise, they're just playing statistical games. You know, when you go to a tide gauge and look at the what they claim is sea level rise, there's two things that can be causing apparent sea level rise. One is that the oceans are rising, and the other is it can be that the land is sinking. And land moves all the time. You know, the northeastern United States is sinking because of what's called glacial rebound. You know, during the last ice age, Canada was the land in Canada and much of the northeastern United States was depressed by huge amounts of ice on it. When the ice melted, that land started to rise, which sort of has caused sort of a teeter-totter effect. The land along the eastern coast of the United States is sinking. And so by cherry-picking the right set of stations, they can make it look like sea level rise has accelerated when, in fact, there really isn't much evidence that it has. And if you look on the west coast of the United States, there's been little or no sea level rise. You go up to in northern Europe, sea level has been falling quite quickly. You know, Stockholm has shown a very steady rate of sea level fall for 140 years, and lots of other stations in northern Europe now. You know, the sea level, the tide gauge at Fort Denison and in Sydney Harbor in Australia has shown little or no sea level rise over the last 140 years. There's lots of historical pictures of Fort Denison from the 1880s. You can't really discern any difference in the high tide mark there than there is now. And I've done similar analysis for like La Jolla, the cove at La Jolla in California. So it's really hard to make any sort of case that sea level rise has accelerated or that humans have anything to do with it.
If the case is so weak, their case, the climate alarmists, at what point is it going to be exposed? Presumably, if these predictions, these dire predictions, don't come true, after a certain point, the whole thing will collapse. When will that be? How long do we wait?
Well, in order for your hypothesis to be true, people would have to have a memory, and people don't remember things very long. And I've documented, hundreds, well over 100 years of failed climate predictions. And actually, Fox News did a story based on my work on that. And so over and over again, we've had all these ridiculous predictions of catastrophes from academics. They fail over and over again. It wasn't just with the climate, like Paul Ehrlich at Stanford University in the 1960s, 1970s was predicting we're going to have terrible famines and water shortages. They all failed. And we had all these predictions of global cooling, which failed. And there's lots of predictions from the first half of the 20th century of global warming, melting the Arctic, flooding, coastal cities. There were predictions that in 1988, the United Nations predicted that the Maldives would be underwater within 30 years. So that would have been 2018. And it hasn't happened. There's been no indication. Tuvalu, the island of Tuvalu in the Pacific, was the poster child of global warming. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there were movies made about how Tuvalu was going to drown. And actually, in recent studies, they discovered the islands are getting larger. So there's just countless. In 1989, the United Nations said we only had until the year 2000 to stop global warming or before it goes beyond human control, and there's going to be mega conflicts around the world and whole countries disappearing under the waves. None of these things came true. And these predictions go on over and over again. There's all these forecasts of doom, and they all fail, and people don't remember. Right? And they just go back to repeating the same garbage over and over again. In 1923, there were predictions made that Glacier National Park in Montana would be ice-free within 25 years. Right? That was 1948. And then a couple years later, there were predictions made that it was going to be ice-free by 1963, and those failed. And then the predictions became that by 2003, Glacier National Park was going to be ice-free. And then the predictions were 2020. And there were signs up at Glacier National Park until this year predicting that it was going to be ice-free by 2020. The National Park Service took them down quietly. And now the claims are 2040, right? So these predictions have been going on for well over 100 years. For 100 years, the Glacier National Park was about to be ice-free. Doesn't happen, but they keep pushing the timeline back, and people don't remember. So it would be nice if people actually had a memory and the press was honest about it and just said, okay, we were wrong. But they don't do that. They just recycle it over and over again. And people remember, the news cycle, the constant 24-hour news cycle makes people forget things they heard yesterday. They can hear a completely different story today than they did yesterday, and many people will just accept it at face value.
All right, we'll take another time out. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines, questions and comments for Tony Heller, realclimatescience.com on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. The Chinese Space Agency's lunar lander has entered orbit after its November 23rd launch and a 112-hour journey. The lander will collect samples of some of the youngest moon rocks, a billion years old, and return them to Earth. By contrast, the examples of lunar material collected by the U.S. and Russia are about 4 billion years old. The planned landing site in the Sea of Storms is the location of an ancient lava field. Equipped with sampling equipment such as a drill and scoop, the mission is scheduled to return about 4.4 kilograms of lunar material sometime between the 15th and 17th of December. The mission is the first of its kind to the moon since the USSR's Lunar 24 lander, which returned 10 grams of lunar soil in 1976, and which remains the most recent sample return. You can read more about this story and see some photos in the highlight carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. Your questions and comments for Tony Heller when Coast to Coast continues right after this. Tony Heller is here from realclimatescience.com. Tony, one of the things we hear repeated over and over, it's like a mantra. 97% of scientists agree that the climate science or climate change is real and that it presents an existential threat to our planet. Where did that 97% statistic come from?
Yeah, I think Obama was the guy who popularized that around 2013, and I believe that the Obama administration actually contracted a guy in Australia, John Cook, I'm not certain that it was from them, but someone did, to come up with some fake statistics about that. there's no truth to that claim. Certainly, you know, like I said previously, you know, pretty much every reasonable scientist accepts the idea of a greenhouse effect, and that by adding more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, that will tend to have some first-order heating effects. So I think that it's a fair statement to say that the vast majority of scientists agree that man-made global warming is real, that by adding more burning carbon dioxide, we should be warming up the Earth somewhat. So I think that statement's true. But where it becomes false is when people start claiming that there's a general consensus that this is dangerous or it's a threat. I think that's a total farce. In fact, the same year which Obama made that claim in 2013, there was a survey done by the American Meteorological Society of their professional members. And just barely over 50% even agreed that humans were primarily responsible for global warming. And they weren't asked if they thought it was dangerous because they probably would have been laughed at for doing that. So I would guess that it's actually a very small percentage of scientists who actually believe that global warming is dangerous. But politicians and the press, starting with Obama, have created this whole fake thing and snowballed it. They've censored any scientists who, with different opinions, and so basically it becomes anyone who disagrees with us isn't a scientist, so all scientists agree with us. That's kind of the attitude of climate alarmists. You know, they define.
Do you have any theories as to what?
They define a scientist as anyone who agrees with what they want to hear.
And any idea why they're pushing this narrative? What's behind it all, do you suppose?
Yeah, so I've been thinking about that a lot lately. And my theory is, you know, Joe Biden said he's going to shut down fossil fuels. You know, there's a video of him talking to someone at a campaign rally. He just looks at it and he says, I guarantee you, I'm going to end fossil fuels, right? And so I think, what does that mean? I mean, what's the point of that? I mean, the United States only produces something like 20% of the world's carbon dioxide. Like, the United States could disappear off the face of the Earth, and the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would still increase at just about the same rate as it is now. The United States is one of the few countries where carbon dioxide levels, the emissions have been decreasing. They've been going down for about 15 years here. So Joe Biden no one in the United States has any control over the use of fossil fuels around the world. Joe Biden's not going to stop China from increasing their fossil fuel usage. You know, they're building hundreds of new coal-fired power plants in China and in other places in Asia. China's building about to finish this huge new coal train. Joe Biden has no control over them. So there's really nothing. Joe Biden has, you know, in European countries pretend they make these fake climate agreements like the Paris Accord and pretend they're doing something. And these agreements don't actually do anything. So what is the bottom line here? You know, what is Biden actually doing? And what it is they're trying to shut down domestic energy production. They want to shut down fracking. They want to shut, you know, right now the United States is the world's number one producer of oil. And they're trying to shut this down. And what this will do is it will shift back to the Middle East, right? We took away, all this fracking took away power from the Middle East. This will push it back to the Middle East. It'll push it back to China it'll push it back to Russia. So it helps out countries like China and Iran and Russia and other countries in the Middle East. And then by becoming dependent on Middle East oil, once again, we get back into the mode, which we were in before Donald Trump, of the perpetual state of war. George Bush Sr. started sort of the perpetual war in the Middle East in 1990. And then it went through, you know, the Clinton administration perpetuated it, the Bush administration did. Obama was bombing everybody in the Middle East, right? And then Trump came along, and he pulled the troops out of Afghanistan. He stopped bombing Syria. He made peace, you know, between Israel and the UAE. So suddenly the perpetual state of war in the Middle East, which the military-industrial complex has relied on, you know, they're in trouble now, right? Trump has taken this away from them. And I think that's why they're so desperate to get rid of them. You know, the military-industrial complex, which Eisenhower warned about in 1961, depends on these wars. And the fracking took that away from. We no longer needed to have all these wars for oil. And so that's why they've been trying to get rid of Trump and why Biden wants to shut down U.S. energy production, because it puts us back into a position where we have an excuse to have wars in the Middle East again.
All right, let's go to the phones. First-time caller James is in Arkansas. James, welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Yes, Richard, for Tony Heller, I've got a comment here that something that we kind of didn't get to was the melting of the ice deposits have redistributed the mass, you know, isotopic redistribution of the mass around the planet. And we had that earthquake with the Fukushima disaster in a 1.5 degree axis, a shift of our planet in one earthquake, and the underwater volcanoes. Dutch team, while they were looking for that, was it MH340? It was a missing flight. They found over 3,000 active volcanoes that were not even known to exist, and that was just in one little area. There's thousands and thousands of volcanoes just going off in the mid-oceanic ridges in the Atlantic and the Pacific now with all this water that's been pushing down. And there's ice-cold water at the bottoms of the oceans. Used to be like 125, 150 foot deep. And measurements of that have shown that those levels have gone down. And when that's, you know, coldest water is gone, the rest of the oceans are going to warm up quicker than they're doing right now. And then there's that balancing act between perspire a little bit out of the ocean and it gets caught in the jet stream and falls over the Great Plains and we start building up an ice shield over Canada again or something like that with the water train. If the Arctic Ocean starts heating up from that Japanese current that goes across to Oregon, if that gets all hot and everything, you know, it'll change the whole climate of the planet. But just want to mention those underwater volcanoes and the methane hydrate that exists. All the known hydrocarbon deposits in a pie chart showed that oil, coal, natural gas account for 20%, and that 80% is methane hydrate that's found about 400 feet below the oceans to that 1,000.
Okay, James, you've given us a lot to chew on here. Let's get Tony in here to respond to some of that, and so we can squeeze in some more calls as well. But great call. Thank you. Tony, do you want to latch on to any of those multiple points?
Good question. I was actually, I was working on methane hydrates at Los Alamos Labs back in around 1980. That was something we were aware of. We've been aware of for a long time that these vast reserves of methane, like you're saying, underneath the oceans. And this is a huge resource of natural gas, which, you know, enough to keep the world running for hundreds and hundreds of years. And if that's great, you know, great question. As far as the volcanoes go, in order to make the historic claim that volcanoes are melting the ice, you would have to be able to show that the amount of volcanic activity had increased. And I don't think there's really a compelling case for that. But during the 1970s, there was a large increase in the amount of or ice in the Arctic, and people are worried about a new ice age coming in. So you'd have to be able to say that if you wanted to claim that the ice melting since the 1970s was due to volcanoes, you would have to be also be able to prove that the amount of volcanic activity has increased over the last, you know, 50 years. And I don't think there's a good case for that. So I'm not a fan of that theory.
All right. The wild card line, Michael, is trucking in Washington. Hey, Michael, welcome to Coast.
Hi, how are you?
Terrific. Thank you.
So I just wanted to say a voice of reason. I love it. I get in this argument all the time, and I actually hit on quite a few points. I try to explain to people, you know, I put it in simple terms, like I was talking to AOC. I think when Barney roamed the earth, trees were bigger, plants were bigger, it was richer in methane, oxygen, CO2. Then one day a big rock hit the earth and caused an ice cream age. Now it's just going back to its natural self. And he's hit on all the points that I was going to bring up. It's just wonderful.
All right, Michael, thank you for that. Safe travels, my friend. Are we heading back to an ice age in your estimation, Tony?
Not any time in the near future. You know, ice ages, a lot of people believe that ice ages are caused by various aspects of the Earth's rotation or Earth's orbit around the sun. You know, their Earth's orbit is not circular, it's elliptical. And depending on the position of some planets like Neptune and Saturn, you know, relative to us, the Earth's orbit gets skewed. And during times when we're far away from the sun in summer, that's believed to be what causes ice ages. And so right, there's no indication that the Earth's orbit is currently getting close to circumstances which are likely to produce an ice age. So I would expect that we're probably still a few thousand years away from entry into a new ice age. Yeah, I may be wrong about that. It's not, the mechanics aren't clearly understood. We've been in an interglacial now for about as long as average, but I don't think there's much indication that we're headed into an ice age anytime soon, though.
East of the Rockies, Bruce is in Ozark, Missouri. Bruce, welcome to Coast.
You want Lewis, Dr. Lewis in Ozark County, Missouri. Richard, you'll get a gold star. This is a great program. Your guest knows his stuff. He hit the nail on the head with the Antarctic ice core samples. That's the winning argument. But I have one problem with this whole thing that I want to ask him about. Is he aware that for millions of years, proved by the ice core samples, there has never been anywhere near as much aluminum particulate in the atmosphere as there is now? And second question, is he aware that aluminum particulate is lethally toxic to all forms of life on Earth?
All right, thank you. Matt,
I've never heard any statistics about aluminum, you know, particles increase. I mean, that sounds like an interesting idea. And certainly,
there is this idea that they're engaged. They, whoever they are, the mysterious they're engaged in this geoengineering, putting these particulates into the atmosphere in order to reflect the sun's rays back out into the atmosphere to forestall global warming. But maybe they're using global warming as an excuse. And putting these particulates into the atmosphere for some other purpose. I don't know.
Well, I know that Bill Gates, you know, wants to put sulfates into the atmosphere to reduce sunlight. I've never heard that about aluminum. As far as the toxicity of aluminum, I've heard for decades that you shouldn't cook with aluminum, you know, pots because aluminum's toxic and causes dementia. So I've always used stainless steel pots, so it wouldn't surprise me if having aluminum in the atmosphere was a bad idea.
Tony, you've been kind of pushed off YouTube. They've tried to censor you, demonetize you. You're moving off of YouTube onto, where are you moving to now?
NewTube.app.
NewTube.
YouTube, you know, they've implemented policies where they can just completely arbitrarily, without any warning or serious explanation, just shut you down. They've done that to me twice now. A couple weeks ago, I cited some statistics about COVID from the CDC and another one from the New York Times, and they just shut me down without any warning. They just said, he said something about you're not allowed to question the authority of the World Health Organization, which I didn't do. But they just have these arbitrary community guidelines where they can shut you down for any reason at any time. And I know that there's people like Tom Steyer in California wanted me shut down for years, and I suspect they're just exerting their force. So now they use any excuse they can to shut me down. So now I've got two strikes out of three from YouTube, so I can't really post any serious content there anymore, because if I do, they'll just use it as an excuse to give me my third strike and delete my channel. So the only thing I'm
so it's newtube.app, newtube.app?
Yeah, it's newtube.app,
and,
right.
All right, and what do we just type in Tony Heller?
Yeah, if you go to newtube.app and type in Tony Heller, you'll get to my new channel. You know, I have about 100,000 subscribers on YouTube, and only less than 6,000 of them have moved over to YouTube. And part of the problem is that, you know, YouTube shut me down. I locked me out of my account without any warning. I don't have any way to communicate with people. They don't have any message on my account that I'm sure, you know, people go in there, just suddenly I'm not posting videos or anything.
Okay, so
telling you what's going on.
All right, we need to push people over to newtube.app and type in Tony Heller, and of course the website realclimatescience.com, realclimatescience.com. Tony, a great pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. It's great talking to you.
All right, when we come back, retrocognition, precognition, EVPs, photography, and more, right here on Coast to Coast AM.